Well, if you rang me around lunchtime today, and some of you did, I would have told you that tonight we're doing Psalm 18. If you were to ring me late this afternoon, which none of you did, I would have told you we weren't doing Psalm 18. So if you're expecting that, I'm sorry. But we're going to 1 Samuel chapter 27 or 20. Yes, let's go to 27. And the reason that we're not doing Psalm 18, in fact, we're not doing a psalm at all tonight, but we're not breaking from our series. We're still in the series of Psalms of David that have a historical reference in 1 Samuel. That's still our series, but tonight there's no psalm. And I'll read some chapters from 1 Samuel and then explain why there's no psalm to go along with it. So 1 Samuel, chapter 27. You'll remember that the psalms that we've been looking at so far, the last two or three of them, have been when David's been in the cave and Saul has been chasing him all around the country, frankly trying to kill him. And David has been in deep despair, truthfully, but looked to God and found great comfort and great hope in God. And at the end of chapter 26, we find that David has spared Saul for a second time. David has gone into the camp and he's seen Saul there, and he's taken the spear and the jug of water that was nearby Saul, and he's taken Saul's spear, and instead of killing Saul with a spear, which obviously he could well have done, he simply went away and then from a distance told Saul what he had done and what he had taken, and demonstrated to Saul that David wasn't trying to kill him. And Saul, at the end of chapter 26, verse 21, says, "I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will harm you no more, because my life was precious in your eyes this day. Indeed, I have played the fool and erred exceedingly." And then in verse 25, Saul says to David, "May you be blessed, my son David. You shall both do great things and also still prevail." So David went on his way, and Saul returned to his place. And David said in his heart, "Now I shall perish some day by the hand of Saul." And the big heading that we have in our New King James Bible, and the big number 27, which wasn't part of the inspired text, breaks up those verses for us a little bit, perhaps unhelpfully. So I'll read the end of verse 25 again. "May you be blessed, my son David. You shall both do great things and also still prevail." So David went on his way, and Saul returned to his place. And David said in his heart, "Now I shall perish some day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than I should speedily escape to the land of the Philistines, and Saul will despair of me to seek me any more in any part of Israel, so I shall escape out of his hand." So David arose and went over with the 600 men who were with him to Achish the son of Maok, king of Gath. So David dwelt with Achish at Gath, he and his men, each man with his household, and David with his two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, and Abigail the Carmelitess, Nabal's widow. And it was told Saul that David fled to Gath, so he sought him no more. Well, we will keep following that story through 1 Samuel, but I'll read bits of it as we go, because I want to cover about four chapters of 1 Samuel, and it would be tricky to keep your attention while I just read that all in one go. But the reason that there's no psalm tonight is that the next psalm, if you look at the historical plan of things, the next psalm will be Psalm 18, and the inscription of Psalm 18 says that it's after David's enemies have been defeated, including Saul. So the next psalm skips us on right into 2 Samuel. And all of these chapters, chapter 27 and 29 and 30, really aren't reflected in the psalms at all. And what I planned to do this evening was to go through these chapters as a quick introduction, then get into Psalm 18. But going through four chapters as a quick introduction, and I didn't want to be long tonight, as we had a long meeting on Monday, and then go into a psalm which is a very long psalm, more than 50 verses in Psalm 18, I thought that was probably biting off a little more than I could chew. So I decided to separate the two. So today, we're going to be looking at these chapters in 1 Samuel, and then next time round, will be perfectly ready for Psalm 18. So if you want a kind of title for tonight, some of you like titles, then you can have this one. There are no psalms in Philistia. There are no psalms in Philistia. And the more I thought about this, the more I thought that that was particularly pertinent for what David was saying. That he's been in the cave, and Saul's been oppressing him, and he's been at really rock bottom, but he's found hope in the Lord, and he's written these psalms as a result. And then later on, much later on, David's enemies are defeated, and Psalm 18 is a glorious psalm. It really does require great justice to be done. It's a wonderful psalm, and David is full of praise for God. But in between times, as far as the psalms are concerned, there's just a long period of silence. And I felt it might be helpful to look at what caused that silence, and this is what we're going to do tonight. So I have 3 points for you. The first is chapter 27, the second is chapter 29, and the third is chapter 30. The first point, chapter 27, is this: out of the frying pan. Out of the frying pan. You see, David, as we've already seen, has been under great difficulty, great stress, great trouble, great hardship, truthfully. And then he decides in verse 27, he says in his heart, "Now I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than I should speedily escape to the land of the Philistines. And Saul will despair of me." So he decides to go to Philistia. Now, of course, he's done this before, hasn't he? And you remember, it wasn't that many chapters ago, was it, where he went down into Gath and got himself into no end of difficulties, and only by pretending to be mad did he manage to extricate himself from the situation. But he does it again. And it's a very clear reminder that sometimes we don't learn from our own mistakes. And David repeats his mistakes. But what caused it? Well, ironically, it's at a time when things seem at last to start going a little better. He's had this experience with Saul that we've read about in chapter 26. Saul, at the moment at least, is peaceable towards David. And David is probably very right to think, well, this isn't going to last very long. And it seems to me that what happened here, that David thought, well, now here's my chance. I've got 600 men. And they've got their wives and children with them, and we're living in these caves. And if you remember, we thought it was perhaps a little bit like Osama bin Laden hiding up in those caves in Afghanistan, and no one seems to be able to find him, no matter what the effort put in. It was a little bit like that, and they were kind of safe there, but it was a pretty miserable existence. And I'm sure even just getting food for these 600 people and their family was a very difficult thing. And it seems to me as though David thought, well, now I've got an opportunity. At the moment, at least, Saul is not breathing out murderous threats towards me. At the moment, at least, I've got a chance. I can perhaps poke my head out of this cave, at least on occasion, without fear that I'll be reported and Saul will find us. This might be my only chance to make for safety. And that's what he does. And chapter 27 and verse 1 tells us that he said in his heart, "Now I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul." And that's a reminder for us that there wasn't actually an urgent situation at the time. It's ironic, isn't it? For the last few chapters, David has been flitting about from cave to cave, having all kinds of difficulties and problems and dark situations with the army against him. And there's been an immediate, very present threat against him. That threat has now lifted in the short time. And instead of thinking, well, I shall perish very soon, I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul. And it's at that moment where the threat is lifted that David seems to betray his weak side. There's a lesson there very often for us, isn't there? Sometimes we can be in very dark and difficult situations and really call out upon the Lord and know that our only hope is in God. And then God is gracious and answers our prayer and our situation eases. And we suddenly think, well, actually, things aren't as bad now. And our need for God seems to be less than it was before. And the very fact that God was gracious to us can often indirectly cause us to move away from God, as we forget to be thankful for the answer to our prayers, And we start to think that maybe we can sort things out on our own now. That's what happened to David. He tried to sort things out on his own. And so he goes down into Gath, and he dwells with Achish, the ruler there, verse 3. And then after a little while, in verse 5, he tells to Achish, he knows that Saul is not chasing him anymore, verse 4, and he says, don't let me stay here with all these people intruding on you. Let me go and live somewhere else, still within Philistia. And he goes and lives in Ziklag, and he takes all his people with him. So off he goes, and then verse 8 tells us what David got up to. And here's a real descent of David now. And David went up and raided the Gershurites, the Gerzites, and the Amalekites. For those nations were inhabitants of the land from of old, as you go to Shur, even as far as the land of Egypt. So here now, David is attacking the enemies of Israel. But they might be the enemies of Israel, but they're the allies of Achish. And Achish has allowed David to live there. So he's kind of still fighting on Israel's side, and maybe he thinks in his own mind that he's fulfilling the will of God, attacking God's enemies. But verse 9 tells us, whenever David attacked the land, he left neither man nor woman alive. But he took the sheep, the oxen, the donkeys, the camels, and the apparel, the clothes, and returned and came to Achish. And then Achish said, "Where have you made a raid today?" And David would say, "Against the southern area of Judah, or against the southern area of the Jerahmeelites, or against the southern area of the Kenites." So what David is doing, he's attacking the Geshurites, the Gerzites, and the Amalekites, and he's telling Achish that he's attacking the people in Judah, or the that's really hard to say, and it doesn't help, it's on two lines, does it, in the Church Bible? Jerahmeelites, there we are, and against the southern area of the Kenites. So that's what David is doing. He's telling Achish that he's attacking Israel's enemies. Sorry, he's telling Achish that he's attacking Achish's enemies, but really he's attacking Israel's enemies. That's what David is doing. He's being quite duplicitous, really, when it comes to this. And not only that, but verse 9 tells us that he's got to kill everybody in case anybody gets away. And verse 11 brings news to Gath, saying, "Lest they should inform on us, saying, thus David did." So for all the time that he was there, that's exactly what David did. It's a very sad existence, really, isn't it, compared to what David was doing before. He thought he was taking himself out of the frying pan. He really did. He thought he was saving himself from the hand of Saul. But really, he was getting himself into a darker and deeper mess. Now, we need to be clear here that the Bible doesn't tell us in any of these chapters that what David did was wrong. Sometimes we get that, don't we? You'll remember, I'm sure, the story of Bathsheba. And there's a very clear line there, "But what David had done displeased the Lord." There's nothing like that here. We don't get any hint of that. There's no comment for good or bad. The writer isn't saying David was right, and the writer is not saying that David is wrong. So what are we to make of this? It certainly seems wrong to us, doesn't it? David appears to be abandoning his hope in the Lord. He's gone into a place where he was in difficulty before with Israel's enemies. He's lying to the king. And he's carrying out these raids, and it may well be that the people that he's raiding deserve to be raided, because they were raiders themselves. But nevertheless, there's something very uneasy about this, isn't there? There's something that we just don't, it doesn't seem right to us. So why doesn't the Bible say so? There's several reasons why the Bible doesn't say so. One is because it wants us to think about the question. And it doesn't want to make life easy for us all the time, because the Bible's not simply a list of this is right and this is wrong, and as long as you do this and don't do that, everything will be okay. Far from it. What the writer wants us to do is to try and enter into the story properly, to try and see things from David's point of view. And he wants us to have an understanding and even a sympathy for David. And frankly, if we've been following this story, and particularly along with the Psalms, and seeing the very depths of despair that David has gone to, and yet that mixed with his own spirituality, the ways in which he's repented, the ways in which he's tried to do the right thing in the eyes of the Lord, but the real struggles that he's had. And when it comes to chapter 27, we have to say, well, in some ways, I'm not surprised that David's been worn down. With all these difficulties and problems, we're not surprised. So the writer wants us to have some sympathy for David. But the writer also wants us to understand that, yes, David has turned his back on God here. So you'll notice that in chapter 27, God doesn't get a mention. God is just not there. He's absent from the whole chapter. And indeed, that's a pattern that we'll see later on as well. That's one of the hints that we have here, that David is at the very depths, not just emotionally, as he has been previously, but now spiritually too. So David is out of the frying pan in chapter 27. And then just the first couple of verses of 28 start to tell us a different story. Now it happened in those days that the Philistines gathered their armies together for war to fight with Israel. And Achish said to David, "You assuredly know that you will go out with me to battle, you and your men." So David said to Achish, "Surely you know what your servant can do." And Achish said to David, "Therefore I will make you one of my chief guardians forever." So those two verses of chapter 28 and then into chapter 29 is my second point. The first point was out of the frying pan. Guess what the second point is? Into the fire. So what does David do now? Here he is, he's been telling Achish of the way in which he's been attacking Judah, and the way in which, and Achish is completely taken in, and he thinks that David is now his friend, excuse me, and an enemy of Saul. And now Achish is planning to attack Israel, and he thinks that, well, David's already been attacking Israel all this time, certainly he'll want to come with me. And it may well be that Achish thought, well, David will want to attack Israel, and then Israel be defeated, and perhaps then Achish will be able to make David king over Israel. Maybe this was partly what was in his mind. So David, in the words of many a wise politician, says everything and nothing. In verse 2, he says to Achish, "Surely you know what your servant can do." And there's deep irony here, because Achish hasn't got the faintest idea what David is going to do. And truthfully, I don't think David has got any idea at all what he's going to do. Chapter 29. We're missing chapter 20 out, because that's all to do, 28 out, that's all to do with Saul and not David. So 29. Then the Philistines gathered together all their armies at Aphek, which where the Israelites can camp by a fountain which is in Jezreel. The lords of the Philistines passed in review by hundreds and by thousands, but David and his men passed in review at the rear with Achish. Then the princes of the Philistines said, "What are these Hebrews doing here?" And Achish said to the princes of the Philistines, "Is this not David, the servant of Saul, king of Israel, who's been with me these days or these years? And to this day I have found no fault in him since he defected to me." But the princes of the Philistines were angry with him. So the princes of the Philistines said to him, "Make this fellow return, that he may go back to the place which you have appointed to, and do not let him go down with us to battle, lest in the battle he become our adversary. For with what could he reconcile himself to his master, if not with the heads of these men?" So here's the situation. David's got himself into, he probably doesn't really know what to do, and he finds himself being taken off to fight the Israelites, and then the Philistines say, "Well, actually, we don't want David fighting on our side, because we'd be worried that as we charge into battle with David at the back, suddenly the tables would be turned, and it would be like having a fifth columnist in your midst, and David and his men would suddenly start fighting against us rather than for us." So Achish is saying, "No, we want David, he's on our side," and the rest of the Philistines are saying, "Well, we don't want him, because we can't trust him." And so the story goes on. Now, last week I started reading a book called Agent Zigzag. Maybe some of you have seen it. It's a true story of a guy called Eddie Chapman. Now, Eddie Chapman is the only British citizen who was awarded the German Iron Cross during the Second World War. He was a spy, and he was originally captured by the Germans in Jersey, and he was then sent into Britain to spy for Germany. And as soon as he landed in Britain, he handed himself in to MI5 and was sent back as a double agent to spy for the British in Germany. And they managed to, it's a great story, they managed to fox the Germans, and the Germans thought that he'd been blowing up these various things in Britain, and they were sending back reports of various new secret weapons that didn't exist and all this kind of thing, and the Germans were taking it all in. It's a wonderfully exciting story. But as you read the book through, you find there's all kinds of situations, and it makes you very glad that you're not a spy and you're certainly not a double agent. And Eddie Chapman gets himself into all kinds of situations, and you think, well, how on earth is he going to get himself out of this one? And somehow he always manages, partly because of the ineptitude of the German equivalent of MI6, and partly because of daring and cunning, and no doubt, if you believe in such things, a good chunk of luck as well. But every time he gets into this situation, you think, well, this is the end for him. There's no way he can get out of this. But he always seems to manage it. And if it wasn't a true story, you wouldn't believe it. It really is incredible. And it's a little bit like that with David. I think he kind of views himself a little bit like a double agent, doesn't he? Because here is Achish thinking that he's on Achish's side, but David is thinking to himself, well, all right, it's unofficial. Saul, I'm not signed up on Saul's side, but I'm still an Israelite. I'm still on Israel's side. So now he's in this situation. He's a double agent, and he's kind of just got to go along with things and hope that somehow he'll be able to get out of it in the end. And these Philistines give him the escape route. But of course, and this is just exactly the same in Agent Zigzag with Eddie Chapman. He can't simply take every escape route very quickly, because then everyone would get suspicious and it would all be a little bit obvious and people would start to doubt him. So he kind of plays along. And there's been times when there's in the Agent Zigzag story when Eddie Chapman could have had a way out, and he didn't take it. And the reason he didn't take it was because if he took it, then that would be the end of the road for him as a spy. He'd be safe, but his mission would be lost. So he doesn't take the escape route. He keeps on going, and you think, well, he really will have to get out of this one. And another escape route passes him by. But by doing so, he's able to get that extra bit of information or that extra thing that he needed in order to be able to fulfill his mission. And David's a little bit like that, I think, in his own mind at least. So in verse 8, he tries to sort of fight against the escape routes. He doesn't fight too hard, but he just fights a little bit enough to be able for Achish to retain his confidence in him. So he says to Achish, well, what have I done to this day? What have you found in your servant as long as I've been with you, that I may not go and fight against the enemies of my lord, my king? Then Achish answered and said to David, I know that you are good in my sight as an angel of God. Nevertheless, the princes of the Philistines have said, he shall not go up into battle. So David doesn't go. And as I said, David kind of argues back a little bit, but he doesn't really boldly fight for his place unreservedly, does he? I mean, he could have kind of rounded up the Philistine guys and says, hey, look, I'm really on your side. Let me prove it to you. Why don't you do this? Perhaps you could send me here and I could go on a little mission away from you, and then you could see that I really have... He doesn't do any of that. There's a little argument, but then he quietly acquiesces. And he's been out of the frying pan. He's now into the fire. But through this, he's been given an escape route by God. Now again, if you read through chapter 29, you'll find that God is not in the thoughts of David at all. He's relying on his own cunning and his own luck. And ironically, we find here that the only time that God is mentioned is by Achish, the Philistine, who doesn't worship God. Verse 6, surely as the Lord lives, you have been upright. So Achish the Philistine, in this chapter, is showing a greater awareness of God, again in verse 9, than David ever is. David really has come to the bottom, it would seem, of his spiritual state. He's out of the frying pan and into the fire. And even though he's managed to get himself out of this very difficult situation militarily, spiritually, he's very much still in the fire at this point. God's thoughts, the thoughts of God, are nowhere near with him. And just to pause at the moment before we come to chapter 30, and just to ask ourselves of whether we have ever been in situations similar to this one of David. Maybe a situation where we've had great difficulty and felt really helped by the Lord in the difficulty. And then the situation eases, and we find ourselves then drifting maybe a little bit, and going back perhaps into sin, and getting ourselves into difficult situations, and then believing somehow that, well, as David, I think, convinced himself that he was a double agent, really on Israel's side, but doing things that, frankly, God had not asked him to do, and probably that God would not have approved of in chapter 27. And maybe sometimes we've been in similar situations, and we say to ourselves, well, these are the circumstances that I'm in, and there's nothing I can do about it, and really it's probably not an ideal situation, but I'm sure things that are okay, and really, if you look at it, it is an honourable thing to do, it is a right thing to do, and we kind of convince ourselves of this. But really, what we're finding is that whilst God is being very gracious to us by keeping us from terrible sin, as David nearly happened in chapter 29, we find really that we're just sinking deeper and deeper spiritually. And you'll notice there's no prayer, there's no worship, there's not even any thought of God in these chapters. So David is still in the fire, spiritually speaking, at the end of chapter 29. So chapter 27, out of the frying pan. Chapter 29, into the fire. Chapter 30, what should we call it? Well, let's read the opening verses. Now it happened when David and his men came to Ziklag, so he's come away from the Philistine army, from the war with the Israelites now. He's coming back to Ziklag, his hometown, or the town that's been his home for the last year or so. On the third day, so it's a 60-mile trek up from the battle area back home. He's spent 3 days travelling up there, a little time there, at least overnight, and then 3 days coming back. He's been away at least a week. That the Amalekites had invaded the south and Ziklag, attacked Ziklag and burned it with fire, and had taken captive the women and those who were there, from small to great. They did not kill anyone, but carried them away and went their way. So David and his men came to the city, and there it was burned with fire, and their wives, their sons, their daughters had been taken captive. Then David and the people who were with him lifted up their voices and wept, until they had no more power to weep. And David's two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail the widow of Nabal the Carmelite, had been taken captive. And just when you think things couldn't get worse, verse 6, now David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him, because the soul of all the people was grieved, every man for his sons and daughters. Just when you thought it couldn't get worse, it did. And David now, is absolutely at rock bottom. We've been saying that for chapters and chapters, haven't we? And you sort of think, well, it can't get worse for David. And then every time we turn the page and go a new chapter, maybe it's hopeful for a little bit, and then it just goes down again. Hopeful for a little bit, and then down again. That's been David's experience over all this time. So, let's not lose the end of verse 6. David's about to be stoned, or at least the people are thinking of stoning him. End of verse 6. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. So the chapter 27 was out of the frying pan, chapter 29 into the fire. Chapter 30, I'm going to call like a brand from the burning. Like a brand from the burning. You see, what has happened to David here is really his sins have found him out, haven't they? Chapter 27 and verse 8 tells us that one of the things that he was doing was raiding the Amalekites. And now it's no surprise that as David is off in this imaginary battle against the Israelites, it's the Amalekites, chapter 30 verse 1, who have come in and turned the tables really on David. And what David has done to them, the Amalekites now are doing to David. We shouldn't be surprised about that. We shouldn't be surprised that those who live by the sword die by the sword. And that is exactly the situation that David very nearly found himself in. And David then comes to the situation when he has lost literally everything. It may well be that he's already given up on the kingship of Israel by this point. And now he's lost his wives in particular, he's lost the support of his men who'd sustained him and kept with him over all these years. And verse 6 says he was greatly distressed. He's lost absolutely everything now. And the situation for David was simply that it seems to me that he'd gone away from God so far and he drifted so much that really there was only one way in which God was able to bring him back. And that was exactly what God did. God took everything away from him, because that was the only way then that David could see his real need of God. And the danger for us, if we're in a similar situation for David and we think that things are pretty bad, actually if we were to look around and think, well, actually we've got a great deal. We could compare ourselves with many around the world and think, well, no, we have an awful lot. And we may think of families, we may think of our home, we may think of various situations and think, well, actually I'm not too badly off. I'm not too badly off. Maybe I felt at rock bottom, but there is still a great deal that I have. And if God needed to, God could take a lot more away from me. And maybe that's a warning to those of us who are drifting from God, to remind ourselves that God could take a lot more away from us in order to bring us lower, in order to lift us up. And David does indeed find himself lifted up by God. So after these 2.5 chapters where God is not mentioned at all, apart from by pagan Achish, suddenly God is back in the equation. Can you see that? Chapter 30, verse 6. David strengthens himself in the Lord his God. And then verse 7, he says to the priest, bring the ephod to me. You remember the ephod is the way that they used in those days to determine the will of God. So now David finally wants to know, God, what do you want me to do? He's not asked the question for chapters and chapters, but now he asks the question, shall I pursue them? And the answer comes back, yes. So off he goes, and he finds this Egyptian who tells him the way to go and explains the situation. What a remarkable providence. Just when his men are weary and his men are unable to go forward, at least some of them, they find this man who is able to help them and encourage them. And this man, verse 15, this Egyptian, takes them there and shows them the people. And they find that they're spread out, verse 16, over all the land, eating and drinking and dancing because of the great spoil. And I'm sure you can well imagine after a sacking of a city, there was a great deal of debauchery and drunkenness and the like. And frankly, that's a very good time to attack the enemy while they're partying from the exertions of the previous days. And that's what David did, verse 17. And he defeats them. And he recovers, verse 18, all that the Amalekites had taken away. Verse 19, nothing of theirs was lacking, either small nor great. What a wonderful picture of the grace of God. David had everything taken away from him, frankly, because he deserved it. David, purely because of his loss and his loneliness, comes back to the Lord. And within a matter of almost hours, or certainly days, everything is restored to him. The confidence of the people, his wives, all of his possessions, everything they have, and even his own spiritual standing. He now is very aware of the glories of God and being aware of how God has helped him. And we even find, as we carry on reading through the end of 1 Samuel and into 2 Samuel, that actually the kingship is on David's way. And around about the time in which all this was going on, Saul himself has been defeated. And this is David's accession to the throne. It's remarkable, isn't it, that in the days before David's accession to the throne, David perhaps in maybe chapter 20 or around about there was doing very well. Things were going quite well. He was a spiritual man. And over time, there were ups, but there were lots of downs. Ups, lots of downs. Ups and lots of downs. And God brings David right to rock bottom when he literally had nothing at all but the clothes he stood up in. He'd lost his respect. He'd lost his hope. He'd lost his wives. He'd lost his home. He'd lost everything, literally everything. And God does that almost immediately before he lifts him up to be the greatest human king of Israel that they've ever had. And there's a real lesson there about leadership, isn't there? And a real lesson there about the way in which God does indeed humble us in order to lift us up. We find that story happening many times throughout the Bible. So we need to marvel at the way in which God prepares his servants. Does it remind you of anybody else? Because there are many people in the Bible who had a similar experience. Perhaps Moses is another very good example. Here's Moses. He's a youngish man. He seems absolutely wonderfully prepared to be a leader of the people. He has all the privilege of the Egyptians and all those things. He seems to be a godly man. Hebrews 11 tells us he didn't want the riches of the kingdom, but he wanted to serve God. He seems to have everything. But in order for him to be able to be a leader of God's people and to do this great work, God has to bring him right down. And just like David, then Moses loses everything. And he's cast out of the royal court. He's in the desert. And again, he's merely got the clothes that he's standing up in. But again, just like with David, Moses gradually gets these things, in a different measure, admittedly, but he gets these things restored to him. He finds a wife and a family and work to do. God speaks to him at the burning bush, and God then is able to lift him up, and now he's ready to be a leader of God's people. We need to be careful, don't we, about the things that we pray for. And we need to be careful about the way in which we ask God in order to deal with us. And it would have been far better, frankly, if neither David nor Moses had done the things that they did. They both sinned, and they both sinned seriously. It would have been better for that not to happen. So we need to be very careful about sin, don't we? We may see ourselves as just dabbling here and there in sinful things. But we need to remember that if God's got great plans for us and we don't know God's plans, then God's going to want people who are absolutely on his side, whose sin has been dealt with, and who know undoubtedly that they are utterly dependent on the Lord. And if we're one of those people who kind of thinks, well, God's a real help to me, but we don't think any more than that, then maybe God too will need to keep bringing us down. And if we're still not ready to keep bringing us down, and maybe we're still not ready, keep bringing us down until we're ready. And when we're ready, God can then lift us up. So here was David. He was out of the frying pan. He was into the fire. And he was a brand from the burning. Where that phrase comes from. It comes from Zechariah chapter 3 and verse 2. Where Zechariah is shown Joshua, the high priest, standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right hand to oppose him. And the Lord said to Satan, "The Lord rebuke you, Satan. The Lord who has chosen Jerusalem rebuke you. Is this not a brand plucked from the fire?" Now Joshua was clothed with filthy garments and was standing before the angel. Then he answered and spoke to those who stood before him, saying, "Take away the filthy garments from him." And to him he said, "See, I have removed your iniquity from you, and I will clothe you with rich robes." And I said, "Let them put a clean turban on his head." So they put a clean turban on his head, and they put the clothes on him, and the angel of the Lord stood by. And you see, Zechariah explains to us what happened to Moses, and what happened to David, and what happens to all of God's people, as we're like fires plucked from the fire. And the reminder that we are clothed with filthy garments, that there is nothing good in us. And that thought needs to humble us and needs to bring us down, in order that God then can lift us up and prepare us for great things. And if you are currently being humbled, you feel, and maybe the reason for that is that God has got great plans for you, and God is preparing you for something great that he wants you to do, and he needs to deal with you before he can do this. And maybe it might, just as for David, be just a matter of days before God lifts you up. Maybe like David in the earlier chapters, it might be many years before God is able to lift you up. But us, each one of us, are brands plucked from the fire and saved by the grace of God alone.